are going to make a small program change to the agenda, and we're going to start today with a public hearing on Senate bill. Note this, colleagues, this is a whole agenda today on Senate bills.
Yes.
On Senate Bill 167. So I'll open the public hearing and ask Ms. Brazeau to come up. We understand that you have a appointment later this afternoon.
Thank you.
I've often said that if I have to choose between appearing in front of a legislative committee or going to the dentist, I would usually choose the dentist, Karen. So.
It's not a root canal.
Hear that? Actually,
thank you.
Representative Anderson were here. Maybe you could have both.
You could have both. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I guess we should ixnay on the dental jokes. Huh? All right.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Karen Brazeau. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. The bill before you, Senate Bill 167, is a bit of a housekeeping bill that probably should have been taken care of some time ago. We're bringing it to you at the urging of risk management. It is solely to clarify that foster parents providing foster care for youth offenders placed in the custody of the youth authority have tort coverage. And this is implied in the existing statute, but as agencies and divisions change names, it has become less clear without going back and doing some research. It is clear when the agency separated from then Children's Services Division in 1995 that was the intent, but the statute makes it very clear by naming the youth authority. I won't read my testimony, but I'll answer any questions that any of the members might have.
Further questions for Ms. Brazeau? So essentially, Karen, this just makes what used to be clear again by being very specific about the access to tort claims coverage for foster parents. And obviously, if this isn't clear, then the tough job you have of recruiting foster parents to take these kids becomes even tougher. Is that right?
That's totally correct, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McPherson.
Karen, what's the experience been in terms of the obligation of OIA to make payment to foster parents whose person or property has been damaged by offending youths that are in their protection?
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, risk management does provide coverage to those foster parents, but they have advised us that making that linkage is getting more difficult as they've had to go back and research this through the existing statutes, and that's why they're suggesting this specific change in the legislation.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, what I was focusing on really is I'm relying here on the measure summary here, which says that provides that OIA is liable without regard to fault for injury to foster parents or damage to their property caused by youth offenders who reside in OIA-certified foster homes. And I just wanted to see if to what extent are we actually making payment because of that. That's a strict liability standard, so it means without regard to whether there's any fault or not, the payment would be made, which strikes me it may well be a reasonable thing to do when we're asking people to take potentially dangerous youths into their homes, but I just wanted to see if there was any experience with our actually having to make payment to foster parents.
I see where you're going, and that is a different question, Representative McPherson, and I don't have with me. I will provide to you, if you would like, the record over the last couple of years, and we have had some payments. They have not been extensive. Generally, when we have foster care youth, they tend to actually just leave the home rather than do any damage. So it's pretty rare that damage is done. I'm sure we have made some payments, but if it was anything extensive, I would have knowledge of it, and I don't have knowledge of it.
And that's sufficient for these purposes. I just wanted to get an impression about what the experience was.
Any other questions? So the standards, I just, for my own edification, colleagues, if you look in the first section of the bill on the second page, you'll note that there are some standards which have to be identified and a showing upon by clear and convincing evidence that the foster child or youth offender committed the theft, for example. I mean, so it's not just submit any claim and get a reimbursement. I mean, there are standards that the foster family has to put forward here and demonstrate before they're reimbursed under the system.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Representative McPherson, the one I can think of most recently was several months ago. In fact, it was very tragic, and a youth that left the foster family took their car without their permission and wrecked their car, and the youth was killed in the process. And, of course, their car was totaled in the process.
Huh. Okay. Anything else for Karen? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else here? Good luck this afternoon. We won't tell Representative Anderson we were making fun of his profession before you.
I heard.
Got up there. Oh, okay. Good. News travels fast. Anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 167? All right. We'll close the public hearing. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
Excuse me. I move SB 167 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 167 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay. Go ahead and call the roll, Anne.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Crummell?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pazanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Representative Crummell, do you want to vote on Senate Bill 167?
No.
Before I put the gavel down, just to give you the count, it's everybody here's voted yes except me, and I haven't voted yet. And I plan on voting yes if you do. So
if I do, okay, I'll be an aye.
All right, show Representative Crummell is an aye. The chair votes aye. Senate Bill 167 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier on this one.
I'll take it.
Representative Ackerman, okay. All right, we'll go back up to the top of the agenda, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 18A. And ask Bob Jundiff to come on forward. Anybody else you have with you, Bob, that you plan on bringing up?
Read on.
Okay, all right.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center, and Senate Bill 18 is a bill that's designed to do two things. One is to add the term neglect to the areas that come under our state law that requires reporting of abuse of people with developmental disabilities or mental illness and investigation of those complaints of abuse. Now, the practice over the last few years has been to investigate situations in which a person's health is put at serious risk as a result of neglect. However, because of the fact that neglect is not included in the statute, it doesn't technically give the Department of Human Services the authority to do investigation, get records, interview staff, et cetera. This would correct that problem. Just for your information, in Oregon, we have four different abuse reporting and investigation schemes for folks who are vulnerable by definition, one for children, one for nursing home residents, one for seniors, and one for people with developmental disabilities and mental illness. This is the only one of those four statutes that does not include neglect leading to physical harm. This would make that statute consistent with the other statutes in Oregon. Secondly, this bill would address the question of training and technical support for people who do those investigations. As a normal matter, investigations are done at the county level. The state designates the county to perform investigations in their area. This merely clarifies that the state should be giving adequate training and oversight for those investigations. On the Senate side, there was an additional piece added to that requirement, and that is that the consultation and training should include addressing cultural and social diversity issues. That was, again, added in by amendment at the request of Senator Gordley. And I believe that the intent was just to make sure that those investigations were sensitive to those issues.
Just a program note, colleagues. I don't think the staff measure summary for Senate Bill 18 has been passed out. Did you find it in your stacks?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did you? All right.
Yeah, it's right here.
Well, somehow Mr. Taylor and I both missed it.
Maybe we didn't pay our bill. I don't know.
Okay. Well, we'll get copies for those of us who didn't get it. Are there questions for Mr. Junda? Representative Crummell, do you have a question?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the Bob, the amendment that you referred to, starting on lines of the A in Gross Bill, starting on lines 15 and about halfway through there, and then ending on line 16, I'm a little concerned about that. And my concern is, we have heard, I think, you know, the horror stories and seen the Stossel reports on 2020 and all this other kind of stuff about, you know, training for the when there's an investigation with regards to whether an investigation is biased or not, and whether how thorough they are and that sort of thing. But one of the things that there's been has always been raised is a question about, and I think it does sort of speak to the diversity issue, but with regards to investigators finding what they wanted to find based on sort of how they asked the questions and that sort of thing. And I'm questioning whether or not this really gets where it is that we're trying to go with that. I don't know if I'm stating it clearly enough or not. I don't like the language, I guess, is probably the best way to put it, because I'm concerned about it raising preconceived notions and having an investigation prove out exactly what the investigator wants it to prove instead of having the investigation show or prove what are actually the facts of the case.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I can give you my opinion, which is that having been the director of the Advocacy Center and worked there since 86, we perform our own abuse investigations from time to time as we're authorized to by law. And occasionally you'll have an individual who's from a minority ethnic group, and there can be specific different types of issues that are raised in the course of an investigation. I remember one just off the top of my head having to do with a Korean national who was in Damish State Hospital, and the problem had to do with the food that the individual's family was bringing in, and the staff thought it was really weird stuff and wouldn't let him have it, and when in fact it was a common food item that's served within that culture. And so having some knowledge and sensitivity of those issues helped to resolve that particular problem at that time. And I believe that Senator Gordley was particularly concerned that just when an investigation is being done, that unusual circumstances that are tied to a person being from a non-majority group are taken into account by the investigator. I personally don't believe that that would compromise the results of the investigation or prompt looking for problems that don't exist, if you will.
Okay. I'm done. Thank you.
All right. Are there other questions? Counsel.
Chair, Mr. Committee, this agenda on reading the definition of neglect that leads to physical harm to withholding of services necessary to maintain health and well-being. Would that include a situation where, for example, because of budget cuts, someone was removed from a program?
Mr. Chair, Council, this question was asked on the Senate side, and I think we made clear that this particular law only pertains to people who are in service. And so if there's a person, by definition, in order to be subject to this law, it doesn't like senior abuse, for example. It only covers people who are in service. So a person who's receiving community mental health services or community developmental disability services is eligible for coverage under this act. If a person is receiving services and those services are somehow failing them, there can be a report and an investigation. If a person is not in services, they're not covered. Second of all, the teeth, if you will, behind the statutory scheme is as follows. If there is a report of abuse and there's an investigation and abuse is substantiated, the only remedy that follows from this statute is that the finding of abuse be reported to licensing agencies. So, for example, that could be an individual license, such as a social worker licensing, or it could be a facility licensure. There's no further remedy that comes from a finding of abuse under the Act.
Council.
Phillips, Chairman of the Committee. So, Mr. Jones, if you're saying if someone's in the program and they're removed from the program, then you're saying that it's not a question of abuse because they're no longer in the program. Is that correct?
That's what I'm saying.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chairman, as the committee, what happens if someone is in the program but their services are reduced? So you'd be saying that then that would be, if I take it correct, neglect?
Mr. Chair, Council, if a person was in services and under care, this may be splitting hairs, but if a person is receiving a particular service, be it residential services or outpatient services, that particular service would have to not result would have to be provided to the degree that it is supposed to be provided. If a person is not in a service, then they're not. Then you're correct; they're not covered. However, what you're dealing with here, I think, is professional standards. If a particular service were cut back, the nature of that service were cut back to the point in which it put that person at risk of harm, there might be a complaint and an investigation. But I believe, and perhaps Eva Kutas from the Department of Human Services could come up and respond to this question, but I think that it would only be a substantiated abuse if the nature of that particular service is being provided inadequately.
Let me see if I can put it in and maybe we ought to have her come up and put it in sort of the factual context. I mean, we're in the situation right now where we're making and have made some fairly substantial reductions to budgets. You've got, in some cases, counties directly or counties through contract that are providing certain mental health services that are being suspended because of lack of funds. So if you've got somebody in one of those programs right now who's, let's say, on an outpatient treatment program, and because of choices that we've made here by necessity or otherwise that have cut the Department of Human Services budget in a pass-through to the county's budget, and now the county has cut the nonprofit's budget who is providing the service, and they're no longer providing the service, are we in a situation where the person could then come forward and file a complaint if they've met the neglect that leads to physical harm, which I think a lot of people could argue some of these cuts we're making are going to actually meet that standard through withholding of services necessary to maintain health or well-being. And all of a sudden we've got up the chain, at some point do you have the DHS having to do an investigation on itself because their budget reduction was the thing that sort of caused the domino effect. And I think we know where you want to go on this. At the same time, I want to be really sure that we don't walk down a path where we create an invitation for all sorts of additional litigation related to the providing of services and creating standards that didn't previously exist as to what the definition of abuse was. So, and unfortunately, I have to step out in the hallway after that great setup. But I do want to hear. I mean, we do want to hear your response. So, do you want to respond to that, Bob, or do you want?
I'd like to take the first cut at it and then hand it over to Eva.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my cut is that I think that the chance of this creating litigation in any way doesn't exist, because this is a law that is set up to require certain people to report when folks who are in service are at risk of harm, and to prompt investigations of those reports. And this, in other words, it's in essence a quality assurance type of mechanism. The only remedy that this law provides, again, is a reporting to licensing agencies that the standard has been met under the law. It does not create a private right of action. It doesn't create a standard of care, even. It merely sets forth a reporting and investigation process. So okay. At that point, I'll hand it over to Ms. Kutosh.
Good afternoon. My name is Eva Kutosh. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Health Services, and the manager for the Office of Investigations and Training, who either oversees the investigation of or directly conducts investigation of abuse and neglect involving adults with mental illness and developmental disabilities. And if you followed all of that, my answer to what you're saying would be that neither in our system or in the senior system do we look at what the ideal or best quality of services would be for a person. When we look at a neglect investigation, we look at what is the standard of care that's been agreed to, usually in some kind of a treatment plan or individualized plan, and whatever that treatment is, we're looking to see whether that standard was met. So we don't come in and say, this person sure could have benefited if they had one-to-one supervision. If one-to-one supervision wasn't what was necessary for the person, then we would not be finding someone guilty of neglect or substantiating neglect. We'd only be, we might recommend that people look at the supervision, but as far as the finding, it's measured against what the plan for the person says.
Any further questions from the committee? Does that include your presentations then? Is there anyone else here that is here to speak on this bill? Please come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Russell. I'm the director for one of the mental health organizations in Oregon, actually one in this five-county region, the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, that provides mental health and chemical dependency services for Oregon Health Plan members. I'm also an associate of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and at our meeting at 12:30 by phone, they noticed that this was coming before you this afternoon and asked if I would just drive across town and share a couple of thoughts. Would you introduce yourself?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Scott Parker. I'm special counsel to the Association of Oregon Counties.
He was also in that phone call. As you heard from Mr. Jundeff, this is an expansion of the investigation responsibility that, without funding, it already falls to the community mental health programs. The expanded definition of adding neglect clearly has great virtue, but the fiscal impact has not been assessed on this bill. And so the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs asked me to ask you to consider that, and that perhaps it should be referred to Ways and Means for measure of that fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, the point that I wanted to make, frankly, Council Taylor and the chair have already brought up. The issue is the issue of cutback in services because of state budget cuts. We're very concerned with the language of definition of neglect would set us up for liability, and frankly, we're concerned on a more global scale about this issue, and hopefully there'll be some proposed legislation to you coming up in the next week or two dealing with this issue. But the concern is, if a number of you have experience with the filing of lawsuits and evaluating how you get a case filed, and one of those things is investigation, this would seem to be, looking at this, an easy way to get a plaintiff's lawyer to get an investigation if his client's been cut off from services, his or her client's been cut off from services. The standard of care that the representative from the department issued, we hope would work. But that's the kind of question that goes to a jury, a lot of zeros sometimes come when the jury makes a judgment that the standard of care hasn't been met. This is a real concern to us, and we think that the definition will cause both the state of Oregon and the service providers, including the counties, a lot of trouble.
Further testimony?
That's it.
Okay. Questions, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Scott, are you saying then that because with this very broad statement in here at the top of page 2 about neglect, if the and since the state contracts with the counties to provide many of these services, and so if the state reduces the amount of money available for the services and the county reduces the services, you are suggesting then that somebody could potentially bring forward a lawsuit based on the fact that the county's neglecting their duties to a particular because there's nothing in the statute that absolves the county from the service because of the contract through legislation that was created, whether it be 2 years ago or 20 years ago. Is that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that's exactly what we're concerned about. And this, there are statutes in Chapter 430 and 431 that cause trouble now. This, we think, is... The language of this is kind of excruciatingly on point. It talks about withholding services. And though we know that's not what's intended, we're afraid it will be used when someone's services wrongly, from their perspective, are cut off and they're injured, made more sick, whatever, they'll be looking for someone to sue. The county, since it was the service provider, even though the state had given the county money and then taken it away, the county would probably be the first named defendant and the state would be the second.
Further questions? Representative Jensen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Chairman. As I read this and look at it, too, it seems to me that liability ultimately will come back to the state. Is that your...
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that would be... We would hope so. But frankly, if you look at the state master contract that at least we've been negotiating here, that's not at all clear. The county might well be the first defendant, and if you were a plaintiff's lawyer, the people that actually cut off the services are the county or the contractor, and then they'll look, and we might or might not be able to successfully tender it to the state, depending on what the state master contract says. That is kind of a unilateral adhesive contract. They pay us money and put stuff in there that might well cause some problems. But we would hope that would be true, but I'm not saying that it would be.
If I could, be amended in such a way as to make it a little more specific and still meet the intention with something like neglect constitutes the withholding of those services in the treatment plan, and realizing that as your funds go down, you may be able to and may be required to change the treatment plan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, that would be very helpful. But if you think about what the representative from the Department of Human Services said about standard of care, you then start thinking about, well, where in the treatment plan is there a mandate where even though you don't have money, you have to make the service available? And that is that's problematical. But I think that would be very helpful, or put something in there like neglect that needs the neglect does not include service cuts that are caused by shortfalls, something like that. That would be helpful compared to what it is now.
If I could follow with just one more, but we are in agreement, I assume, that the issue of neglect is of such value that it should be addressed somewhere in statute, that it can be so detrimental that it should be addressed in the statute someplace. Is that fair or unfair?
I'll let Mr. Russell speak to that.
That seems fair. As Mr. Jundeth said, it appears in other regulations and statutes in the same.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Are
there further questions? Okay. Well, I apologize that I missed part of the discussion from the counties on this, but I'll be informed by the rest of the committee. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 18 at this point. And I think, Mr. Jundeth, if we're going to want to ruminate on it a little bit, might be helpful to maybe sit down with the counties and you guys talk possibly about things you might be able to do. Does that sound reasonable? Kurt? Encourage you to work with Mr. Taylor. Okay, we're going to now go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 70. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill creates a procedure for establishing general guardianship for children within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court and sets standards and procedures to establish, modify, review, and terminate such guardianships. This comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Justice, Oregon Law Commission, excuse me.
All right, and Lisa Kay and Wendy Johnson. Welcome, and whoever wants to shoot first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. I just wanted to introduce the three bills that are up today. We have three Oregon Law Commission bills before you, Senate Bill 70, Senate Bill 71, and Senate Bill 72. All three of these bills come to you from the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group of the Oregon Law Commission that was chaired by Senator Kate Brown. On that Juvenile Code Work Group, we have over 50 members, mostly judges and lawyers from across the state, but representing the multitude of views, just district attorneys, defense attorneys, judges, those in private practice, and those from the various state agencies. All three of these bills do come to you from on the recommendation of that work group as well as the recommendation of the Oregon Law Commission. The first bill before you today is Senate Bill 70, the guardianship bill. Lisa Kay from the Juvenile Rights Project chaired that sub-work group for Senator Kate Brown, and she will be explaining the details of that bill and answering your questions.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Kay. I'm an attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project and a volunteer for the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group. Work on Senate Bill 70 started in September of 2001 and included all of the members that Ms. Johnson talked to you about, attorneys, judges from various counties, representatives from CASA, juvenile departments, the Department of Human Services, the State Court Administrator's Office, Indigent Defense Services, the Oregon Department of Justice, and County District Attorney's Offices. Senate Bill 70 establishes clear standards and procedures for the appointment of guardians for abused and neglected children who are wards of the juvenile court. It also provides clear standards and procedures to modify, review, and vacate those guardianships. One of the most important aspects of Senate Bill 70 is that it provides safeguards for abused and neglected children who are living with court-appointed guardians. One of the ways it does that is the bill calls for a home study to be completed on the proposed guardian before the guardian is appointed by the court. It also requires the guardian to submit annual reports to the juvenile court that will talk about the welfare of the child in their care. The bill allows the court or parties to the case to request a review hearing if the guardianship needs to be modified. Current law, juvenile law, lacks sufficiently clear standards and procedures in these areas that I've talked about. When the work group got together, the sources of these bill of this bill came from two major sources. One was that the sub-work group looked at juvenile court statutes from all over the country and really tried to pull out the pieces of those statutes that were the best parts of those statutes. Also, what's emerged in the place of the lack of sufficient standards in Oregon is some unwritten practice. And there are some practices around juvenile court guardianships that are working very well. And the committee wanted to put into statute those practices that are working well. So moving on to the actual sections of the bill, Section 2 creates the standards for a juvenile court guardianship, including the burden of proof. And the meat of this section is actually, of Section 2, is in Subsection 5, where it talks about the standards to appoint a guardian for a child who's been abused or neglected. And that would be that the child cannot safely return home to the parent within a reasonable time. And reasonable time has a particular definition in juvenile law that looks at the parent's abilities to change their conditions or circumstances and the child's adjustment and how long they've been in foster care. It also states that adoption is not an appropriate plan for a child. Under the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which is a federal law, there is a continuum of permanency options for children that need to be explored if the children cannot return home. And the preference is that if children cannot return home to their parents, that they are placed for adoption and in another permanent family. That the court must also find that the proposed guardian is suitable to meet the needs of the child and that the guardianship is in the best interests of the child. Section 3 talks about the court orders for guardianships and this section includes the requirement that the guardian submit annual reports to the court. And there are a variety of things that the court can do once the court receives that report. The court must review the report and cause it to become part of the juvenile court file. If the guardian does not submit a guardianship report for some reason, or there are concerns about what's contained in the guardianship report, the court can refer that case to the local citizen review board. So the citizen review board will conduct a more thorough review. And the citizen review board is a group of volunteers that works under the court system that reviews juvenile court cases and provides information about those cases to the juvenile court. Section 4 contains the provisions for modifying, reviewing, or vacating a guardianship. And when we looked at when a guardianship should be vacated, we had lots of discussions about what should happen when a parent comes back years later and has changed their conditions and circumstances. Maybe they've had been through drug treatment and it's 3 years down the road and they're doing well. What should the court look at when considering taking the child out of that guardianship that has been stable and returning the child to the care of the parents? So there are some standards for the court to look at, including whether it's in the child's best interest to terminate the guardianship. Section 5 is the home study requirement section. And this states that when a child is in the custody of the Department of Human Services, the Department of Human Services must file a report to the court regarding the suitability of the proposed guardian and whether the guardianship is in the best interest of the child. Frequently, the guardians for the children were also the foster parents. And in Oregon, a lot of times the foster parents for children are a relative. So the guardians are people that the court and DHS knows well. Currently, there is a practice where DHS does submit a report to the juvenile court on the suitability of the guardian. And some of the reason, because of the efforts the Department of Human Service is already making that is not in statute is a reason why there is not a fiscal impact from the Department of Human Services, because they're already meeting many of these requirements. There were some sections of the juvenile code that needed to be amended to follow these new standards and procedures that were developed. And Section 6 amends 419B365. 419B365 is the permanent guardianship statute, and a permanent guardianship is appropriate for children whose parents' conditions and circumstances are such that their parents meet the termination of parental rights standards, but for the children, an adoption is not an appropriate plan. And the permanent guardianship is an important option among the continuum of permanency options for children, but it's sometimes used infrequently because of the parameters around the requirements. The permanent guardianship statute used to require, or currently requires, individuals to refer to the probate code to follow the probate code procedures for appointing a juvenile court guardianship. One of the things that this created is just confusion, because you're looking in the juvenile code and then you have to go back to the probate code and use those procedures, and it can be confusing to watch. Also, there are some procedures within the probate department or probate code that don't quite fit when you're looking at meeting the ongoing safety and well-being needs of abused and neglected children. So Section 6 amends the permanent guardianship statute so it will follow the other procedures that I've talked about, including the home study, the modification procedures, and the order procedures. Section 8 gives the Citizen Review Board the authority to review guardianship cases when the court refers a case to the Citizen Review Board. Section 9 of the bill includes a minor amendment. This is amends 419A 255, and that this governs confidentiality of juvenile court orders. And this allows a guardian to disclose the letters of guardianship to people when it's necessary to do so to meet the duties of the guardian. We wanted them to not violate current law when they needed to disclose their letters of guardianship. And Section 10 of the bill amends 419B370, and this is a clarification. We don't feel it does anything substantive, but clarifies some of the language. I am available for any questions.
Are there questions for Ms. Kay? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, so looking through this, I did not see where the language specifically states the court has the authority to substitute guardians. It's written in terms of modification and vacating. I suppose it's arguable that's within the inherent authority of the court, but I wanted to put something on the record as to how that would take place.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, and you're exactly right. It's in modification of the it's in the section regarding modification, and it doesn't talk specifically about substitution. One of the reasons why, when you're looking at appointing a new guardian for a child, we wanted to make sure that you went through the actual procedures of the code, which require a home study. We want to make sure that if a guardian is being substituted, that there is a new home study that's done mm-hmm. on that child. So that is the way it would be accomplished, and the court would modify the guardianship, would have to have a new home study, and then could appoint a new guardian.
Back to square one with a new guardian then.
Right. Okay. Exactly.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Section 2, Sub 2 and Sub 3, in Sub 2, the evidence must be established, the reasons must be established by a preponderance of evidence. And in sub 3, as far as Indian child is concerned, by clear and convincing evidence. Mm-hmm. The reason for the difference, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen. It's because the Indian Child Welfare Act is a federal law which requires a higher burden of proof for children who fall within that act. So, for example, in a termination of parental rights case, for children, Indian children, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. For other children, it's clear and convincing evidence. So federal law bumps up the burden of proof to a more stringent standard.
Follow, please.
You may.
And I assume then in section 6 sub 4, where we go beyond a reasonable doubt, we're raising it to a higher standard here than we are clear and convincing. And again, that is, you're telling me that that's consistent with what the federal Indian Indian Child Welfare Act.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's exactly right. It's consistent with federal law.
Thank you.
Ms. Kay, you know what would be helpful for me is just to maybe get, I've heard and I looked at the report and I read the language, but just, I mean, give me an example of a fact situation where we've got a child where, you know, we're making the determination that we need one of these general guardianships where they can't go home. Adoption is inappropriate. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the... Give me an idea, maybe for the committee, to just get an understanding of the kind of situation that would require this kind of a general guardianship.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, I can think of a case where an 11-year-old boy was living with his adult sister. He did not want to be adopted by his sister. He had a good relationship with his father, although his father was unfortunately in and out of drug treatment and was stable for certain periods of time and clean and sober, but seemed to relapse on a pretty consistent basis. So the court had determined that this 11-year-old child was not going to return home to his father and couldn't wait for the father to finally succeed in drug and alcohol treatment. The mother was deceased. And so in that circumstance, the court placed that child in a guardianship with his sister because it was the most appropriate plan. It was a permanent plan for that child. He knew that was the plan for him was to grow up there. He still had a relationship with his father. His father, when he was working, paid child support. And he visited his father when it was appropriate to visit with his father, and he was clean and sober.
Okay, we spent a lot of time in this committee with the folks from support enforcement and a fair amount of time talking about the federal act that required us to, you know, move expeditiously mm-hmm. to either make a go or a no-go right. decision on termination or right. adoption. How does this fit into that construct?
Mr. Chair, a guardianship is an option in a permanency continuum, and that law is the Adoption and Safe Families Act. It's a federal law that was passed in 1997, and when a child has been in care 15 out of the last 22 months, the child, under the federal law, should be placed in some kind of permanent placement option. And for the child that I just described, for various reasons, it was determined that adoption was not appropriate for that child. And then there are a variety of permanency options, and under that would be a guardianship.
So this essentially then counts for one of the permanency options.
Mr. Chair, exactly.
Right. Are there any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else to come forward on this bill? All right, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 70. We'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move Senate Bill 70 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 70 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Okay, call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative
Podolsky. Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye.
Senate Bill 70 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation from the committee. Volunteer? Anybody? We've got three of these. I'll agree.
We've got three volunteers.
I'll agree to take one of them. Who will, Representative Jensen will assign Representative Jensen. All right. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 71. And I think on 71, we're going to get Ms. Johnson back. Wendy, you should have just stayed up there. I meant to tell you to stay. You can stay for 72, in case I forget to tell you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. Senate Bill 71, again, comes to you from the Juvenile Code Work Group. Ted Meese chaired this work group and is unable to attend today, so I'll be speaking on behalf of Ted Meese from the Department of Justice. Last session, House Bill 2611 created the Juvenile Court Dependency Procedure Code, and part of that procedure code has to do with summons and service of process. The legislature clearly placed service by mail into the alternative service category with House Bill 2611 last session. This bill would take it out of alternative service and put it back into one of the regular listed service of summons processes. This is in line with the ORCP. It has some other technical fixes as well, but basically what we're doing is bringing service by mail back into the list of methods. Just to go a quick section-by-section analysis, Section 1 does add the service by mail into the list, and then in Section 2 of the bill, it actually defines what service by mail means, and that section tracks ORCP 7D1, the list part does. I would just note that prior to the list of methods, there's a caveat on the types of methods you can use, and it has to be in a manner reasonably calculated under all the circumstances to apprise the person served of the existence and pendency of the juvenile proceeding. So in other words, we're adding service by mail back in, but it doesn't mean that attorneys won't be using personal service as their general method. So this does track the ORCP with the reasonable standard there. In Section 2, Sub 4 of the bill, it brings a provision that defines service by mail, and that's in ORCP 7D2D little I, and that it just brings it into the Juvenile Dependency Code. I'd emphasize here that the mail summons requires mailing of the summons and the petition by both first-class mail and then either certified, registered, or express mail, but it has to be return receipt requested. So it's not just mail. You have to get a signature, so there isn't a doubt of whether we have a problem with service. And then also in Section 2, Sub 5, it fixes up some unclear provisions related to alternative service. And then in Sub 7, we're tracking what's in the ORCP also as what first-class mail means. It's distinguished from certified and registered mail. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, this is a real barn burner, this one, colleagues. Are there questions? Representative Frozanski.
I want to see if I can burn the barn down. What is the history, Wendy, as to why they took it out of being one of the primary or a means of service and put it into an alternate?
I don't have the exact details, but it was written in the passive voice prior to 2611, and so it wasn't clear whether you needed an order or not. It just said service by mail was permitted. And practice, attorneys were not getting an order, so they were not using it as alternative process. But when it was written into the bill last session, it was clearly stuck under alternative process.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Representative Crummell.
Two questions. First one is of counsel. Is there an amended version to this bill? Because your SMS says Senate Bill 71A, but I don't have a copy of an amended bill. I don't have an A in gross version. So is 71 it?
I thought this was amended in the Senate, but I unfortunately don't have the updated.
Mr. Chair, counsel, Representative Crummell, I'm not aware of an amendment
in the Senate about the bill.
Right.
In fact, we had to put the hearing over.
I just said 71.
I may have been ahead of myself.
I don't believe it got amended.
I don't see an A on anything I have here.
And would have an A in our file if there was an A coming from the Senate.
Right.
So
So there isn't an A.
There isn't an A. So no. And it's actually posted on the schedule today. It's just 71 with no A.
My mistake.
So. And I trust Patsy more than I do Bill.
Yeah, I care.
Okay. And now for my substantive question. So for a mail copy to be complete, you have to send a first-class copy and you have to send a registered, certified, registered return receipt requested that requires a signature. Am I correct in that? So you have to send both of them.
That is correct. That's okay. Correct.
Representative Brzezinski.
But the signature has to be the person that just means served.
That is correct.
Care of it, anybody.
That is correct.
Anybody else?
Ready for a motion.
Service by mail.
It's a new concept, isn't it?
Well, no, it's just all this service stuff just gets so darn thorny. I mean,
someday we'll get the service by email.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Jensen.
It's the service by mail, and then the service by registered mail. Is the farmer supposed to get there first so that if the person doesn't want to sign the other one, they can get out of town?
Mr. Chair,
Representative.
My friends, that's always been kind of a tactical decision that you need to make when you're sending it out.
It's one day late.
That's right. Depending on who's getting it.
Depending on who's
right.
getting it.
Well, and what the statute says.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else? Okay. I'm ready for closing the work session or the public hearing on Senate Bill 71, and I'm going to open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 71 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 71 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
As not amended.
As not amended.
All right. Call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Como?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. Senate Bill 71 to the floor with a due pass. Representative Brzezinski,
sure.
I think I'm going to give him this one just because he can answer questions about substituted mail service on the floor, on the fly.
Or just straight mail service.
All right. We're going to go to public hearing on 72, Senate Bill 72, Council.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 72A clarifies that ORS 419B116 is the only statute governing the process for granting parties the right to intervene in a juvenile dependency proceedings, et cetera. It comes from the Oregon Law Commission again.
Ms. Gus, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Linda Gus. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm an Assistant Attorney in charge of the Human Services section of the General Counsel Division, and my primary duty, in fact, my only duty, is to be the contact attorney for the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program. And as is my duty, I participate in the Oregon Law Commission at the request of the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program. Senate Bill 72 seeks to do a couple of things. First, it resolves inconsistencies between a couple of statutes. Hard to believe that there would be a couple of inconsistent statutes. It establishes and clarifies standards and procedures for granting intervention in juvenile court proceedings and for granting rights of limited participation in juvenile dependency proceedings. And it rearranges the statutes in a way that makes a little bit more sense. Parties to juvenile dependency hearings generally include parents, legal guardians, the state, the Department of Human Services, and those parties have certain rights under the code. They can have counsel, call witnesses, request hearings, and appeal. Persons may become parties by intervening in a dependency proceeding, and under some amendments to the code a couple of years ago, a person may intervene if they have a caregiver relationship with a child, which is specifically defined. The person seeking to intervene must prove that caregiver relationship, must also show that intervention is in the best interest of the child, the reason for the intervention, what relief is sought, and that the existing parties cannot protect the best interests of the child without intervention. Interveners often are grandparents or other relatives who may have had custody of or lived with the dependent child before the child came to the attention of the juvenile court. Foster parents may also seek to intervene once they've had the child in their custody for at least 12 months. Step-parents are also folks who might seek to intervene. Persons who may not qualify to intervene in a proceeding may actually seek rights of limited participation. They are not parties to the juvenile proceeding, but are only given rights, the limited rights that are specifically granted by the juvenile court. Persons who seek to have rights of limited participation generally do not have a caregiver relationship, but nevertheless must show that their participation in the proceeding is somehow in the best interest of the child. They must also show why participation is sought and what rights they seek, and they must also show that the other parties to the proceeding cannot adequately present the case. Examples of persons who might seek limited participation include grandparents or relatives who never lived with the child, but are seeking now to become involved in the child's life. Sometimes these folks have been estranged from the parent or the child. They may not have known the whereabouts of the child, and in some cases, based upon a putative father relationship, they may have not even known that the child existed. Looking at the bill section by section, it's actually quite a short bill. Section 1 amends ORS 419B875, deleting all of the provisions regarding rights of limited participation and moving those provisions to another section. Section 2 amends the same statute, but this is a provision that doesn't become effective until October 1 of 03. So sections 1 and 2 actually look identical. It's just that section 1 amends current statutes and section 2 amends statutes that become effective in October. Section 3 amends ORS 419B116, and this is where we add rights of limited participation. What is also added in this section are procedures for objecting to a motion for rights of limited participation, procedures regarding hearings, and a standard of proof. Section 4 amends ORS 109119, which in the past was the statute that governed intervention in juvenile court proceedings. However, as I said recently, 419B116 was created to exclusively govern intervention in juvenile court proceedings. So 109119 references to wardship, which is generally only established by a juvenile court, and cross-references to the juvenile code mean that 109119 actually conflicts with the juvenile code. And so all of those references are deleted so that the juvenile code within itself contains all of the provisions related to intervening in juvenile court hearings. Section 5 amends the same statute, the same explanation with regard to 1 and 2 applies here. So sections 4 and 5 actually amend the same statutes. 1 is effective now, 1 becomes effective in October. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Linda, could you explain to us the reason for the effective now and effective in October, why that matters in this bill?
Well, it matters because come October 1 of 03, the two statutes, Section 2 and Section 5, will become effective. And what I understand is changed in those two statutes is references to court-appointed counsel will now be references to appointed counsel. So effective October 1 of 03, the current statutes are deleted and the new statutes go into effect with those changes. So you have to amend both the current statute and the statute that will go into effect in October.
And remind us, what is it that we've done that's going to cause that October date? Are we talking about the public services defense?
Mr. Chair, what you've done that changes that is that you have amended the provisions in 419B875 and 109119 that reference court-appointed counsel.
Right.
And so effective October 1, references to court-appointed counsel in those bills, those statutes, will become appointed counsel.
Right.
And as I understand it, that's effective throughout the entire statutory
scheme. Right. And I think it is the bill that we had implementing the Public Services Defense Commission, where you get your appointed counsel, and my recollection is we put a bill through already that advances those dates from the October start date to a July start date because we wanted it to kick off at the beginning of the biennium. So it's actually, assuming that the bill that we've sent through that advances that schedule makes it, it actually would be July and not October when that new set of statutes would become effective. Which sort of begs the question, you know, I mean, so there's going to be the short-term effect on the current statute and then the effect on the July statute. But the fact that we're the fact that we've advanced those changes to that from that October date to July date shouldn't have any impact on this bill, should it?
Chair Williams, I don't know. I can check that out with legislative counsel. I left it up to Ms. Vanderbilt to assure that the amendments were to the proper statutes. That's why you see sections 1 and 2 and 4 and 5 are identical. I presume that it will be, it will not affect that, but I can certainly check that out.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to me that the fact that we simply advanced the date that those statutes would become effective from October to July doesn't seem likely to me that that would have any effect on this bill. It doesn't seem like it ought to, if it's all working right. But I've said that before, I guess, and found myself in trouble. But I think, do we have any other questions for Ms. Guess? Okay. I think what we ought to do then is first see if there's anybody else here who wants to talk about Senate Bill 72A. Okay. Then we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. We'll open a work session. And colleagues, I think what we'll do on this is we'll go ahead and assume that I'm right, that it wouldn't matter, and we'll have Mr. Taylor check with legislative counsel to make sure that there's not something else that we have to fix, or if it needed to be fixed, maybe it would be done in a conflict amendment if there was need to do that. And we'll go ahead and move this bill out. And if there is some problem, we've got a long enough third reading calendar, and the way that process is working right now, we have plenty of time to pull it back and fix it if we need to fix something before it gets to the floor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Then I would move Senate Bill 72A to the floor of the House for the due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 72A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Okay. Go ahead and call the roll, Ian.
Representative Barclay?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Trumbull?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 72A goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barker, you've been itching to carry one all day today, so this one's yours.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, that concludes our business for the afternoon committee. We stand adjourned.